Welcome back to the second part of my conversation with Olin Steinhauer, author of The Cairo Affair. This part of the discussion, we'll keep talking about the latest book, but also discuss Olin's approach to fiction and what lies ahead as he continues writing in the thriller and espionage genre. So let's continue the conversation. Well, on a different tangent, one thing I thought was somewhat interesting, too, was the way in your fiction you're sort of exploring these cultures. And you've lived all over the world. What's your perspective, having spent some time in America and the East and West Coast? One thing struck me was the darkness that really lies at the heart of some of what you're, the history you're dealing with in Eastern Europe, and then the complex and political, religious, cultural, social, ancient history that lies at the heart of some place like Cairo. You think Americans have a grasp of all that complexity and the sort of baggage that lies at the bottom of it? Sometimes it seems like we're such a young place and culture that we don't connect with these darker, more complex places.
Yeah. I think that's true. This is the whole idea of me, part of my project being to show people that things are more complicated than they seem. Because in a place like Egypt, things are complicated by, you know, centuries of history in a way that they're not here. And then you can ask, okay, what does that mean? Not just for Americans understanding the rest of the world, but what does it say about American culture itself? And I don't mean that as a criticism, just like a question. These cultures are a certain way. American culture is something different because of its shorter history. I mean, people are bringing much more ancient histories to us, but essentially American culture, begins with the Declaration of Independence, I suppose. And what kind of culture is this? I mean, I notice this is just a different feeling when I come back. And I don't know, I mean, I'm from this culture. It is my culture. And so I come back and I see it and I feel like, oh, things feel different. And I'm always curious about what that difference is. And I don't have an answer. I'm not leading up to some grand statement on this, but I notice the difference. My wife is Serbian, as I said, and she's noticing differences too. And one thing she said today, which is very interesting, is that she notices in sort of where right now we're in Pelham, which is a suburb of New York City, and it has sort of a suburban feel. But she notices anxiety in people, anxiety over crime or health or what have you. And she notices this, and she was saying, well, it's strange that people here have anxiety, but they have the same, it feels like a similar sort of anxiety to people who have lived in war-torn countries. And my wife says that having escaped Yugoslavia when the war was underway, and she considers herself in a way a refugee from war, not in the most tragic sense, but that's part of her, and she has her own anxieties about the world, which are rooted in some ways in that. But she recognizes similar sort of anxieties here, and she's asking herself, well, where does it come from? There's no war going on. And that's an interesting question, and I hadn't thought of it, and it's something, as I'm writing, I'll look into it a little bit and see if something interesting comes of it. But it's nice to travel and come back and look at your culture anew. But it's also nice to have someone with you for whom this is entirely new, and seeing it entirely through her eyes is eye-opening in a lot of ways.
I wanted to ask you also about a publicity sort of aspect of it, where you did sort of a tie-in, a teaser of sorts, for the book. Tell us a little bit about how that came about and what you found that to be. I know you had done some shorter pieces on Kindle before, but nothing that had sort of explicitly tied in. Yeah. I thought it was a very well done, something you could enjoy on its own, but also that really piqued your interest in the Cairo affair. What was that like, and how did you wrestle with that?
Well, it was entirely a request from my publisher, and I said, okay, I'll do this if I can come up with a story. You know, I didn't agree to it immediately. To me, the character who had gotten the least amount of attention was John Calhoun, the contractor at the CIA. And I was very fond of him as a character. And I realized sort of he's important in certain parts of the novel and other parts he's not. So I wanted to focus on him a little bit more. And it was just from some throwaway line that he had been in Lisbon before. And I wanted to... And I'd always wanted to tell a rendition story. And so it was as simple as that, sitting down and coming up with something that would be traumatic enough to be a story, but also might lead him to Cairo. And it worked out nicely. I was surprised. I sort of wish I saw a lot of the comments on Amazon. So a lot of people were pissed off that it was only a short story for 99 cents. My God. But I suppose that's life.
There's a weird sort of part of the culture on Amazon is very, very sort of price obsessed.
Oh,
like there's some sort of your book's too expensive.
Yeah.
So those people always come out, but I mean, I can't imagine getting upset with 99 cents. I thought your 2011 piece, You Know What's Going On, was another fascinating, story on that short story level. I think actually, I just wonder if that is an interesting avenue for authors now where, you know, it's hard to get a short story published in a magazine and that whole type of process. And now an ebook version is a much more direct way to experiment with that form. Do you think that's something that might be an avenue for success for authors in the future?
Yeah, no, I think it can be. Of course, on Amazon, everyone's going to expect it to be free, and that is something one has to deal with. But I think if you're an established author, I think it's legitimate for you to charge 99 cents for a story. In that case, with You Know What's Going On, really in the last, I don't know, probably 10 years, all my short stories have been by request. So that was for the anthology, Agents of Treachery, put together by Otto Penzler. And so he requested a short story, and I ended up writing that. And then afterwards, the book had come out, it had made whatever waves it made, and I thought, what am I going to do with this story now? I really liked it. And I even considered maybe fleshing it out into a novel. Then I realized, no, the story is told. It's done. And so selling it on ebook was sort of the next option. I think I was looking at my bank account, too, at the time. And I thought, my God, I need another line of income. And, I think it's a good avenue. And there's been... the thing I worry about with ebooks and self-publishing is not the people are doing it, is that it's affecting sort of the price point for people, because many writers are so desperate to be published, they will put their stuff on, you know, they'll put a huge novel on for 99 cents or free, and it's creating this expectation in the market that I fear will devalue the written word. The way blogs, you know, people are always asking for free writing in a way that didn't happen 20 years ago. You know, it's almost expected that people will write articles for free. And, you know, I've done it myself. You know, I'm certainly not throwing stones, but you know, and when this starts leading into novels and such, I sort of worry about writers' incomes being dropped too far.
Well, how do you balance that? I know, unfortunately, you had what I thought was a really great, engaging multi-author blog, and everybody kind of, it had its run and you pulled back and you've experimented a little bit with some, you know, social media and Tumblr and different things. Is it hard to balance that? I know a number of authors have told me that publishers really want authors to build a platform and grow an audience.
Yeah, they do.
Is it hard to balance that and actually, you know, do the work for which you're going to be judged on?
Yeah, I mean, I find it hard, but I'm a lot less professional than a lot of novelists. I mean, you know, I got into this game because all I wanted to do was sit and write novels. And I, you know, even doing appearances or something like that is just, you know, it's, I don't dread it. I enjoy it when I do it, but I always think, oh man, I have to go do this. But a lot of writers, and particularly, I think if they're a little bit younger than me, you know, they've grown up with social media around them and they consider this par for the course. Well, of course I'm going to keep my blog going or update my Facebook page 12 times a day. To me, this is all just gets in the way of me writing novels. And I'm not famous enough yet to be a real curmudgeon. So I know there's these realities of the situation. I have to do this. I'm not particularly good at it. And one of the reasons we closed down Contemporary Nomad is that none of us on there were keeping up appearances. We would go through moments of enthusiasm when we had some ideas. We'd be fighting about stuff on there, and that was fine. And then it would just go dead for a month or two. And I finally told everybody, look, if we're not going to do this, you know, you've got a week to start writing stuff. And nobody did. So I said, okay, we'll shut it down, which is fine. It was great. It was a fun experience. But yeah, I'm a little bit frustrated that I have to do this stuff, but come on, there's, you know, if that's all I have to complain about, it's not so bad.
Well, do you find, is there a certain, where does the pressure, is there an eternal pressure that you know that your publisher and your audience expects it? Is there a sort of direct?
Well, it's direct from, you know, my publisher will ask me directly, not about starting a new blog or something. These were my ideas, but keeping up Facebook and Twitter, those are sort of direct orders from on high. And, you know, they're not just making this stuff up. They have good numbers for all this. You know, they show me the numbers on, you know, how it works for other authors who really engage in this. And, you know, and the results are good. They get large numbers of people listening to them and getting ready to go out and buy the books. But I still have this old world image of the writer in my head. John Le Carré doesn't sit around and blog or do Facebook posts. And he never did.
Does it feel sort of odd to be so self-promoting too? I know some authors have felt weird about that. Like posting, you know, reviews, glowing reviews of your book or sort of always pushing yourself has, you know, some people find that off-putting, like unauthentic, that I have to kind of constantly sell my writing. The writing should stand on its own. I shouldn't have to sort of hard sell it all the time on social media.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's gray areas there. I know there are authors who are, you know, rabidly self-promoting, and I find that sort of embarrassing. I would never reach that level. But, you know, if I get a great review in the LA Times or something, yeah, I'll Twitter that. But I won't go, you know, I'll just have a link to it and say, hey, great review. And that's it. And the one thing that makes it a little better is that I see on Facebook and on Twitter regular fans who, I say regular, like they come back often, you know, congratulating me and saying, oh, this is really great. It's such a good book. And this is something you don't get living in your house, cut off from everyone and not engaging in social activity. You don't learn that there are actually people out there who are rooting for you. And that's something I've learned, which is a great thing to take away from all this. I mean, it sounds a bit sappy, but it's good, particularly when I've lived the last decade in Budapest, completely disconnected from any sort of fan base. You know, a few of my books were published in Hungary, but I'm essentially like an unpublished author there. No one knows who I am. Only my friends know. And a lot of them are journalists and stuff. So they're going to be cool about it. And, you know, I was always surprised when I would fly over to New York for something and I'd find myself in a room with critics or editors or something like that, that they were actually listening to me and paying attention. And I was thinking, well, how do they know who I am? You know, I just a guy who writes stuff sitting, you know, in my office. But now, you know, I know I get sort of daily feedback from people, and that's nice. That's nice.
Speaking of that, what? Maybe this is a difficult question, but what is it, the thinking by writing part that drives you to be a writer? Is it the sort of finished product that you feel like an accomplishment? Yes, this is, you know, I'm happy with this novel. All the work paid off and I feel like I've accomplished something. You know, you seem so focused and driven on just being a novelist and really have, that's been your aim all along. What's at the bottom of that? Is the writing process itself, the wrestling with ideas? What makes you go through all the crap you have to go through to be an author these days?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, because as everybody knows, writing is a relatively painful thing to do, particularly the way I go about it. You know, I keep making mistakes, having to throw away pages. But you have these moments. I mean, I'm on top of the world when I solve a narrative problem. And it could just be a narrative problem that only matters for like 5 pages. And then after that, I'll have new narrative problems to deal with. Because writing a novel is like 1,000 different decisions that you're making. And again, like our earlier subject, you're making decisions based on limited information because you don't know where the novel's going. But you have to make them to continue writing. And the act of finishing a novel is, you know, it fills me with pride. It's one of those sins that kind of keeps you going. Seeing the novel finished, knowing that it's good. And when I finish a book, I don't know it's good. Usually by the time I finish a book, I assume it's not good because I can't see it clearly. And I have to wait for my editor and agent to tell me if it's any good. And then months later, I'll reread it with clear eyes and go, then actually that's where the real joy comes, because I've gotten out of it long enough to be able to see it clearly. And then I go, oh, wow, that's good. I did that. You know, and I have this kind of, and it's pride, really. It's pride. And as far as the writing is thinking and it being a way for me to get to know the world better, sometimes that happens. Sometimes I'm aware of it. I think most of the times I'm unaware. You know, you learn these little things about the world as you're writing. And sometimes in this period, when I reread the book much later, I'll be surprised by something smart I said. And then I'll realize afterwards, oh, I really believe that. and then it becomes part of my understanding of the world. This happened sort of the most clear memory I have of that was in liberation movements when I wrote the book and I sent it to my editor and she said, I really liked the book. But there's something weird here in this book. I mean, in all your previous books, it used to be about, what was it? About how politics affected people. And in this one, you seem to be saying that the politics doesn't matter. It's all about people, about individuals and their traumas affecting politics. Essentially, the idea is that people are not doing things. People never do anything, people never do anything for political reasons, only personal reasons. And they use politics as a way. They happen to be in the political world. But they're always acting out of personal interest or personal trauma. Their political views are shaped by their childhood, say. And she said that, and I said, oh, did I say that? And I had to look at the book again, and I go through. And I went, yeah. And actually, that the fact that she said that helped me, like, focus that theme a little bit more and in my edits. And I was like, wow, hey, that's pretty clever. You know what? I do believe that. And I didn't know I believed that until after I wrote it and gave it to someone, and she commented on it. Anyways, these sorts of leaps are sort of fascinating. And that was another moment of, hey, I'm glad I'm doing this.
I think that's still probably my favorite book of yours.
Really? Oh, that's great. I'm always afraid that, because I love it, but there's the use of psychokinesis in it, which takes it out of the sort of pure reality, the pure realism of all the other books. And I sometimes wonder if I shouldn't have written that book within the sequence.
Oh, I thought it worked both as somewhat unique and also within the sequence. I think I've read it like 3 times. So.
Oh, wow. Oh, thank you.
Let's talk a little bit about, as we wrap up, about the future. First of all, I have to ask you about the movie, which people insist on saying has already been made, but it's not been
made. I love that. It's hilarious. In the what was that?
The USA Today.
Exactly, USA Today. Yeah, no. So, okay. So, quickly, the backstory is that in 2008, George Clooney and Warner Brothers optioned the film. They kept the option for a couple of years, but the script didn't come together. So they gave back the rights to me, which was fine because those option payments bought us an apartment in Budapest. So I will not complain. During this period, the film The Tourist came out with Angelina Jolie and Brad Pitt. No, it wasn't Brad Pitt. Sorry, Johnny Depp. And which was not particularly good, but it's actually a remake of a French film that is not called The Tourist. Yet for some reason, they decided to call this The Tourist. So a lot of people actually went into that film thinking it was mine. And some people came out of the film thinking they had just twisted my novel beyond recognition. But recently, it was last year, the rights were optioned again. And this is Sony, with Doug Liman to direct. He's the one who's picking up the rights. And again, we're just in script stage, which they've been for the last year. And either something will happen or it won't. I don't know.
Okay, so the movie's still technically a possibility.
Yes.
What about the next book, All the Old Knives?
Right. Now that was an interesting one because it was the quickest book I've ever written. It was inspired by when we were living in California and giving California a try. I saw on PBS this BBC production called The Song of Lunch, and it was a dramatization of a Christopher Reed poem. Christopher Reed's a British poet, and it was amazing. It was just two people over lunch. It was Alan Rickman and Emma Thompson. And you're getting the whole text of the poem in Alan Rickman's head. And it's some excruciating lunch because they're ex-lovers. He's sort of a failed or past his prime editor. She's living in Paris these days, married to a famous novelist. And he is dripping with bitterness over this. He's still in love with her, of course, and he's childish and everything. And it's just, it's mesmerizing. And I remember watching that, and I thought, wow, if I could do this with a spy novel, have a spy novel just over a table, two people over a table, that would be fantastic. And later that year, in summer, we were in Novi Sad, Serbia, where we visit, where my wife is from. And it was blistering hot outside. They get terrible summers there. And I just started writing. And it took me 4 weeks, and I'd written it. And ended up doing very few edits. I just burned through it. And it's a shorter novel. It's about half the length of my normal novel, my books. It's about 50,000 words. And I'm really pleased with it. I cheated. It doesn't all take place over dinner, but that is the framing device. And you get flashbacks to Vienna where the two protagonists were working out of the CIA station and a very bad terrorist action happened.
So that is coming in 2015?
Yes, 2015. And right now, I'm working on something that's tentatively called Tatters. And that is about homegrown terrorism, really. And it's a complete, it's not a complete departure. We still have, we still have various sort of clandestine behavior. But it's a departure in that I am the main character, or the narrator, at least. I, Olin. And it includes my wife and daughter, kind of our lifestyle here at this moment. And it deals with American, not Marxist terrorists, but there's something like that. They're much more destructive than that. And it's hard to explain, so I won't. I tried to explain it to my wife this morning, and we sat for an hour as I'm kind of going in different directions, multiple characters and stuff. But I'm not going to say it's experimental. It's just different than a lot of the stuff I've written, but hopefully thrilling and exciting. We'll see when it's done.
So that's sometime in the to-be-determined future.
Yeah, I mean, hopefully I'll finish it this year. It'll be 2016.
Well, that sounds always good to have a few more books in the pipeline. Our readers...
Tell me about it.
I'm sure from an author's perspective, good to know there's a couple of books at least still in the pipeline.
No, that's true. Actually, having finished all the old knives, essentially, you know, 1 month of work, and I satisfied another year, in a way, in the publishing schedule. And that gave me some time to experiment and play with other things. So I've been fooling with the screenplay format some. I worked on a screenplay with someone here, and I'm just trying out that form. Maybe something for the future.
Sounds exciting. Well, time to wrap up with the internet. Kids these days, you know, they have short attention spans.
Yeah.
We have been talking with Olin Steinhauer, author of most recently The Cairo Affair, which is available online and at your favorite local bookstore. Go ahead and pick it up. Well, Olin, as always, been a pleasure talking with you, and thanks for coming on, and best luck in the future.
Well, thanks a lot, Kevin. It's always a pleasure.